this is Dr. Lynn Johnson. Lynn was, I like to say, one of the founding fathers of IONS here in this area. He was one of a small group of individuals, Carol's husband, Martin Tanner, who got together initially and saw, like, when was that?
Early 90s.
The early 90s.
About 93, I think.
Okay, good. Yeah. And initially formed this group. They met in another location, and the group grew and grew until we came to this location. He's one of the initial founding fathers, but has some additional insights, not only being familiar with near-death experiences and having talked with a good many people who have had those, but is also a psychologist, personal psychologist, working with people with a variety of psychological needs, and he has a rather unique perspective and life. So let me turn the time over to Lynn Johnson.
Now, in 1984, I sat down with my grandfather, and I had a tape recorder. I said, "Grandpa, how old are you today?" He said, "Well, I'm 82 years old today." It's wonderful. "I want to ask you a few things about your life." "Well," he said, "I don't remember much about my life. Remember when I was 3 years old, we moved to Tropic, and I met a little boy across the street, and he started talking to me about the things he remembered, which was phenomenal. He knew his first grade teacher, and the boy that sat next to him, and the girl sat beside him, and then the second grade teacher, and the third grade teacher. He had a remarkable memory. And it was a very productive hour and a half I spent with him. And at the end, his wife, we called her Aunt Myrtle, she married Grandpa after my grandmother died. Aunt Myrtle said, "Now, Joe, tell him about that experience you had at mine." "Oh, he probably wouldn't be interested in that." I said, "Well, I'm interested in it, Grandpa. Why don't you tell me?" He would have been eating his lunch, and he was leaning back against a steel beam. And he said, for no reason that he could tell, all of a sudden, his spirit came out of his body. And he said, how free he felt. He just felt wonderful. And he didn't have to make any effort whatsoever to move. You just thought of where you wanted to go and you just go there. And then he said, "I was just having the most wonderful time, and suddenly a strange thought occurred to me," he said. "I left my jacket back there." And he made his way back, and there was his body leaning against this steel girder. And he said, "I reached down to pick up my jacket, and something grabbed me, and I was back in my body." He was kind of sorry. And he said, "Never fear death. It's the most wonderful thing you can imagine." Now, a couple of years later, I was talking to a friend of mine at the University of Utah, Dr. Ted Packard. We were just chatting about things in general. And he said he had some money, research. "Did I have any research ideas?" "Well, I've always got a lot of ideas." And I said, "You know, one thing that you might want to consider is doing a study on these near-death experiences. People don't talk about them much, but I think they're out there." In fact, the night that I made that recording, I went back to the house, back to my mom and dad's house, and Dad had been picking apricots. And so I rolled up my sleeves, and we spent the evening bottling apricots. And I turned the tape on. We worked, and we listened to this tape, and at the end of the tape, where Grandpa talked about the experience he had at the mine, Dad dried off his hands and went over and picked up the phone, and he called his brother. And he said to my Uncle Sheldon, he said, "Sheldon, you ought to come down and listen to this tape Lynn has made of Dad. There are things on here I've never heard before." And I said to Ted Packard at the university, I thought that there were people out there that had had these near-death experiences. And I thought that if we reached out to them, they'd probably want to tell us about them. And so we did. We located 32 people who had had near-death experiences. They were wonderful experiences. They were very powerful, enlightening experiences. It was a changing life experience for me. It was phenomenal. Ted and I did a few papers on that. I gave some talks to some medical groups. And a few years later, a man named Martin Tanner contacted me, and he had heard that we had done these investigations of near-death experiences. He wanted to know what we'd learned, and so I was on Martin's radio program several times talking about near-death experiences. One thing led to another, and I said to Martin one day, you've met some people with near-death experiences. Why don't we put together a support group? Now, why would you want a support group if you'd had a near-death experience? Well, what I talked to you about was about my grandfather. How many people had he told about that experience? Well, he told his wife. I don't know if he ever told my grandmother or not. He did tell Aunt Myrtle. What do you think of that? Things are happening people have never talked about. One of the women that was in our near-death experience had, in the 1950s, a medical operation go very badly in a hospital. And she said, suddenly, she was above her body, looking at the surgeons working on this body. And they sewed her up, and they said, send her back to the recovery, put her on life support, and we'll see if she'll pull through. She's out of the body all the time. She said, she followed the body out of the operating room and towards the intensive care unit. Just for the fun of it, she said, I wonder how fast I can go around the corner. And she said, she went zip, and she went around the corner really quickly. And they wheeled her into the ICU, and there was her mother in there, crying and seeing her daughter apparently dying. And she thought, I wonder if I can just go through the wall. She walked up to the wall, when she moved up to the wall, and she said, it's like the particles in the wall opened up and let her through. It was the most amazing experience she'd ever had. I said, well, what did that do for you in terms of your religious activity? And she said, I lost interest in religion. Because I went to talk to the priest, and I asked him about these things, and he didn't know a thing about it. And I thought to myself, I'm the only one on earth who knows. Everyone else thinks it. Everyone else believes, everyone else has opinions. I'm the only one who knows. That had a very powerful experience on me, and the impact it had on me was it kind of broke my heart. I felt sad for her. From the late 50s until basically the late 70s, maybe 20 years, she didn't know that anyone else on earth knew. She felt completely alone. And she felt like a fish out of water. She felt like nothing fit for her. Her husband, she was not able to have children. It was a side effect of the bad operation that she had. And her husband was very happy about that because he didn't want children. And so he was a medical doctor in Nashville, Tennessee, and they had a lovely home, and they were in the country club, and they drove new cars, and they hung out with the rich people in town. And she didn't care. She kept saying to him, well, but none of this matters. He says, it sure does matter. We hang out with the best people in town. You know, we're in the most exclusive country club in town. We've made it. We're successful. Finally, she gave up and said, look, I don't even want to be married to you anymore. Says, I'm going to move to British Columbia and live in a cabin. So it spoke to me about what? It spoke to me about the alienation that you have. If something like this happens to you, nothing in the world seems the same. Arvin told me of a man that I never did meet who he said was from Park City. And after his near-death experience, he wanted to sell their Park City home and move down to Rose Park. And the family went ballistic. Are you kidding? That's a slum. Crummy people live there. And he says, yeah, exactly. They need our help. He said, this doesn't mean anything. And his wife and his kids said, it sure enough does mean something. This home's worth over $1 million. We don't want to move, but it doesn't mean anything. See, so we started this near-death support group. So Dave asked me if I would talk about what I'd learned from these years. I used to be the president, and then I resigned. I said, this was not an experience that I had. I've studied it, I've interviewed people, but it's not something I've had, and people with near-death experiences should be running the thing, not me. Let's talk for a minute about what you can learn from this so that you don't have to have a near-death experience. The trouble with these near-death experiences is they can be disruptive in your life. I have a high deductible medical insurance. If I have a near-death experience, it's going to cost me $3,000. I don't want to have one. I'm happy with what I've learned secondhand, and I want you to be happy with what you can learn secondhand. The week I decided that Ted and I were going to do this near-death experience, two patients told me about experiences they had. I didn't ask them. I wasn't looking for it. I didn't expect it. It came out of the blue. One of them said, you know, he said, my experience was an interesting one. He said, he was in the sleeper cab of a semi going out of Reno and up over Donner Pass, and it was snowing heavily. I've been over that pass when it's been snowing. It's kind of an exciting drive. They lost control. The truck rolled. They had a load of steel, and the steel rolled over the sleeper cab that he was in. He said, as far as they could tell, pretty much every bone in his body was broken. And he said, now, I didn't go through a tunnel. I didn't see a light. All I did was I could feel myself die. I could feel like my life had concentrated itself right here in the center of my chest, and I had a choice. And he thought, I can live or I can die. And about that time, a doctor who had seen the wreck stopped and rushed over to him and took a syringe and plunged it right into his heart and gave him a shot of adrenaline. And that kept his heart going, and then he started tying up the bleeders as quickly as he could, and pretty soon an ambulance came and he got to the hospital and he said, so I didn't have the experiences that other people had, but the one thing I can tell you is that it was incredibly pleasurable. Dying is the most fun you will ever have. I think one of the people that we brought in once, actually brought him in several times, was a fellow from Cincinnati by the name of Howard Storm. And he said one time that there's no need to be fearful of anything. He said, what's the worst that can happen? You can be in terrible pain and you can die. I've been both. Not a big deal. So there's no reason to be fearful. Now, we live in a world where fear is part of our life. But one thing that we learn from many of our near-death experiencers is there's really no need to be fearful. Why are we fearful? What are we afraid of? We're afraid of loss. We're afraid of judgment of other people. We're afraid of looking bad. We're afraid of losing the things that are dear to us. We're afraid of being hurt, being sick, or dying. All those things will happen to you whether you're afraid or not. You will lose things that are important to you. You'll be hurt. You'll be embarrassed. You'll make mistakes. People will turn on you. You'll be in pain and then you'll die. What's the point of being afraid? Fear is the feeling inside that I am not enough. I don't measure up. There's something lacking in me. And what we learn from our near-death friends is that there is nothing lacking. You're fine. You're doing fine. We've only met two people who've been to hell. Isn't that a relief? Afraid you'll go to hell? You have to get into training if you're going to go to hell. It's not an easy thing to accomplish. Howard Storm went to hell. And again, I heard him say once, now I didn't go to hell because I was an atheist. I believe there will be atheists in heaven. I went to hell because I was an angry, egotistical, self-centered atheist. The other one was Jose Mesa. I don't know if he's ever spoken or not. He will come and speak. I asked him one time to do it. He's a nice guy. He's a social worker for Valley Mental Health. And I got to know him, and he told me about his near-death experience, which consisted of him going home with his band after a gig. And he said, hey, we've been taking amphetamines. I can't sleep tonight. Let's stop at the drug house and get some drugs so I can sleep. And they said, Jose, you shouldn't be taking any more drugs. You're on methadone now. He said, I don't care. I'm all jazzed up. I can't sleep. He says, I'll just get a little heroin. That'll help me go to sleep. And they stopped at the drug house. And the connection said, Jose, you have no veins left, man. Can't find any veins, he said. Here, jugular, right here. Poke around, you'll find it. So they gave him a shot of heroin right in the jugular vein. Jose went out, got in the car, and immediately stopped breathing. So his band rushed him to his mother's house, basically dumped him in the living room and said, "I think there's something wrong with Jose. He's got to go right now." So all of a sudden, Jose comes out of his unconsciousness, and there's a man standing over him. And the man reaches down and takes him by the arms and pulls him into an upright position, out of his body. Jose says, "No!" He pulls back. The man does it again. He says, "Jose, we have to go." "No!" He pulls back. He says a third time, "Jose, we have to go." Pulls him up and says, "Come on, it's time to go." They start out, go in a horizontal direction. They don't go up. A lot of people go upward towards the light. If you're going horizontally and there's no light, it's not a good sign. You might be on the wrong track. He said at one point, something very bright was coming towards them, and this man took Jose behind some sort of a shield while the bright thing went by. And all of a sudden, he was wherever he was supposed to go, and Jose says, "I was in jail. I had been in jail before. I knew what it was like. And I knew that this was jail." And there were a group of people there, and they were standing around looking at him. Now, there were no bars or anything, but he said, "It felt like jail. Intuitively, I felt like this is jail." Jose looks at this group of people, and he hears them, and they're talking to each other, and they say, "Who is he? Do you know how he got here? Did somebody bring him? Did you see who came with him? Who is he anyway? Do you know how he got here? Did somebody bring him?" And they were talking like this. And you could hear them. There were two men jumping up in the back. Hey, look at us. There were people he'd known. One had overdosed on heroin. The other one had been shot in a bad drug deal. And Jose knew where he was. And he felt terrible. And he said, "I gritted my teeth." And in the Bible it says, a gnashing of teeth. And he said, "I gnashed my teeth." And he said, and he cried out, he just cried, "Oh God, I did not want to die a sinner. Oh God, I did not want to die a sinner." He said it three times. "Oh God, I did not want to die a sinner." And immediately a light appeared. He said it was brighter than 100 suns. And Jose turns his head away and covers his eyes, and the light goes right through him. And he can see a figure in this light, and the figure says to him, "Jose, why are you here?" And Jose says, "I'm here because I lied and I cheated and I stole. I'm here because I played with my life." And the figure in the light says, "Jose, don't play with your life anymore." And he's in the back of an ambulance with an endotracheal tube down his throat, and he coughs the tube out and sits up and says, "Where are you taking me? Did my mother rat me out? Am I going to jail?" And he said, the guy in the back of the ambulance jumped up and hit his head on the top of the ambulance and yelled, "Turn on the lights, he's alive." So, what do we learn from that? One of the things we learn from that, it is foolish beyond words to feel hopeless. It's foolish beyond words to feel like there's no more chance. Jose was given another chance. It took him months to get free of the drugs. He continued to play with his life for a while. In fact, one day he said, Satan appeared, the devil, and said, "I've got you, and I'm going to get your son too." And he said, "No, you won't." And he went to Odyssey House, and he got cleaned out, and got his wife back, got his children back, got his life back, went to school, became a social worker. Interesting guy, very gentle, loving, kind guy. He's got these gang tattoos on his forearms, you know, it's sort of incongruous, you know. Doesn't look like a kind of a gangster, but he was at one time. Why should you fear? Jose was in hell, and all he had to do was sincerely pray, and he was given another chance. What is there to fear? Fear enough. Sharla told me her life, her near-death experience, and she said, "I didn't go through a tunnel or see a light." She said, "Suddenly I was in a room, and the room, the walls were made of light. I felt wonderful. Suddenly a man in a white robe shows up and says, 'Sharla, you're not supposed to be here. You need to go back.' She says, 'I don't think so.' I like it very much. This is the best I've ever felt. Thank you very much. I don't think I'm going back. And the man said, Charlotte, your husband can't raise your children. And Charlotte said, children? Oh, yeah, that's right. I have children, don't I? Oh, all right. And so, before she leaves, he says, now look, I'm going to tell you two things, and I want you to remember these because they're very important. Number one, you have this idea that God doesn't love you, he just tolerates you, and that's a very, very bad idea. That's completely wrong. God does love you. And number two, the world was made for your enjoyment and pleasure, and you are not enjoying it, and that is wrong. She said, since then, I'll look at a bird on a branch and just rejoice. I'll be so thankful for a glass of cold water. I'll be happy with a hot day, a cold day. You know, I have a reputation of bringing bad weather. I think that's a splendid reputation. There is no such thing as bad weather, only inappropriate clothing. Be optimistic, be hopeful, be believing. Things will work out. Life is far too important to take seriously. G.K. Chesterton once said, angels can fly because they take themselves lightly. Let's talk about how you could learn to be optimistic if you don't have a near-death experience that teaches you how positive and hopeful the world is. I'll give you a simple one. Why don't you keep a diary? And in your diary, write down where you'd like to be a month from now, 3 months from now, 6 months from now, and write it out in some real detail. This is what I'd like. This is where I want. Now, a lot of people's goals are not very good goals because they're focused on what I don't want to happen. That's a bad goal. It's called a negative goal. Like that old Homer and Jethro joke, I don't want to drink anymore. Of course, you don't want to drink any less either. Negative goals are an absence of something. I want to not be anxious. I want to not be angry. I want to not be jealous. Those are not good goals. They're not inspiring goals. What would you be instead of angry? What's the opposite of anger? Happy, peaceful, compassionate. What's the opposite of fearful? Hopeful. Having faith, having hope, having courage, grit. The best show that John Wayne ever made, True Grit. Hang in there. Hope for the best. If you write down the kind of things you'd like to see in your life in the next 3 months, 6 months, a year, we now have very good evidence that people who do that become more optimistic. They start looking for those things that they're looking for. Okay. How about this? You feel grateful for the things that have happened to you. A lot of folks who talk to us about their near-death experiences did come back with a lot of gratitude, feelings of gratitude. You don't have to have a near-death experience for that. Why don't you just keep a gratitude journal? Write down in your diary every day 3 or 4 or 5 things that you personally feel good about, feel happy about. Things that happened that day that you feel grateful for that you would like to have continue in your life. We have a very large study now that found that people who simply did a gratitude diary, writing 3 to 5 things a day that they felt grateful for, improved more. In fact, they recovered entirely from depression without any other treatment, and they recovered better than standard treatment, meaning therapy or therapy plus medication. I think that's pretty impressive, don't you? One little thing, you just keep a gratitude diary. When I ask people to keep a gratitude diary, I have a postscript to it. And I'll explain my postscript. Don Woods was a beloved member of our group for many years. He's meeting with a better group of people now. He died a few years ago. And Don had cystic fibrosis. And he goes through the tunnel, and there's the light, and there's God behind the light. And God says to Don, Don, come and be with me now. No more happiness than you ever thought was possible. Don said, what? How can that be? How can I be worthy of that? And God said, because of the pain you suffered, you learned as much in 37 years as most of my children learn in 87 years. Don says, why did I have to suffer that pain? I tried to be a good guy. You know, I prayed that the pain would be taken from me. Every day it was painful. Every breath was pain. Every time you breathe, pain. So the great thing about being dead is it didn't hurt to breathe. One of us once asked Donald, "What were you breathing, Don?" "Love." I don't know. It didn't hurt to breathe. I liked that a lot. And he said, "Why did I have to suffer that pain?" And God just showed him. And Don sees himself in a group of people. And in this group of people, there's someone standing in front of them. And this person is saying, "Now, if you go to Earth and take on a physical body, there are two ways to learn, fast and slow. The fast way involves a lot of pain. For example, cystic fibrosis." And then he wrote the word cystic fibrosis in front of the group. One day, Don and I were talking and said, "All right, Don, what language was it in?" And he laughed and he said, "That shows what a fool you are." And I said, "Well, I know I'm a fool, but I'm not sure why I'm being a fool right now." And he said, "It was a vision given to me, and so it was in English so that I could understand what the word was." So in other words, the vision was meaningful to him. And he said, "Cystic fibrosis." And then he turned to the group and he said, "Now, for example, this disease causes a lot of physical pain. So the people that take on this disease learn a lot faster than people who wouldn't. Do I have any volunteers in this group for that disease?" Don says, suddenly he remembers what was in his heart of hearts, what was in his deepest heart. And what was there is, "Be careful, you don't know what pain is, you do not know what you're getting into here." But he raised his hand, he said, "I'll volunteer for that, I want to learn fast." Now, did that change his attitude about his pain? Did it change his attitude about his fatal disease? In fact, 37 years is a whole lot longer than most people with cystic fibrosis ever hope to live. He said he was trying to talk his wife into, the woman that became his wife, he was trying to talk her into marrying him, and he said to her, "Look, you're not really taking that big of a chance. I'll probably be dead in a couple of years anyway." It changed his attitude. He saw his pain as a blessing in disguise. And so in my assignment to depressed people, I say, okay, write 3 to 5 things every day that you feel grateful for, things that you did and things that people did for you, and good weather, like it's snowing right now out in Draper where I live, and so I'm thrilled. Thank you. And then write down one thing that irritated you, one thing that upset you, one thing that disappointed you, and brainstorm and say, how could it be a blessing? Because there's nothing bad that can really happen to you. If your heart's in the right place, even when you're in pain, even when you're suffering, even when your friends turn against you, even when you're dying, it's all great. It's all part of what you signed up for. It's all part of the experience that you agreed to when you came to Earth. Pat Rippon was in my original group. I wish I could find her. She disappeared about 1990 or so, but probably she got married and changed her last name. I think that's highly inconsiderate of her. She and I were on TV 2 or 3 times together. When she was 17, she had had enough. Her mother was a schizophrenic alcoholic, which means she was either crazy or drunk. It's a bad combination. She didn't have any mothering, and finally she said, "That's it, I've had it." She found something in a brother's chemistry set that she thought looked deadly, and she went into the bathroom, locked the door, drank it down, and then sat down on the floor and waited to die. Well, after a bit, she goes unconscious, and she starts thrashing around in seizures, and she's vomiting, and they hear this, the mother, the brother, and something bad is going on. And they break down the bathroom door, and they take her to the hospital. This was in the days before hospitals had to take anyone that showed up, by the way. That's a new law. Did you know that it used to be that hospitals didn't have to take you when you came to the hospital? And they said, "Well, you don't have insurance. How will we get paid for caring for your daughter?" So Patricia suddenly becomes aware that she's hovering over a gurney. And there are 2 men standing on each side of the gurney. And she says, not only can she hear what they are saying, but she can directly feel their feelings. Now that's worth knowing, by the way. Why? Well, because I hear a lot of people that are unhappy. No one knows how I feel. And I say, that's absolutely right, and no one will ever know how you feel until you're dead. It's just the fact of life. When you came to Earth, you gave up the right to know how other people feel. You cannot feel that. You can make pretty good educated guesses, and that's all you can do. You understand that? That's the way life is. A physical body limits you in so many ways. We have several hours. There's someone here I'd bring up an interview about that very topic, but I won't do it tonight. She could feel their feelings. One man felt cold and angry, and the other felt confused and concerned and warm. And the cold, angry man said, go tell that woman her daughter just died. And the other man said, well, shouldn't you do that? First man says, listen, if you want to be a doctor, you have to give people bad news. It's part of our job. The second man said, isn't there anything else we could try? So at that moment, there were two people on either side of Pat, and they said to her, Patricia, are you ready to die now? She said, oh, yes. Yes, 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 I want to die. And they said, listen to this, we don't want you to die. Not in this way, not now. You were sent to Earth to learn something, and you have not learned it yet, and if you don't learn it this way, you'll have to learn it in another way that's much more painful. Pat is 17. What does a 17-year-old tell you when you say something like that to her? Come on, yes. I don't care. I mean, any of you raised kids? I don't care. I don't care, she said. No one loves me. And they said, no, that's not true. Your mother does love you. She's just a very sick woman, and she doesn't know how to show it. And then they show her. And at the ER, the mother is begging for them to admit Pat. And she says, look, I work here at night as a janitor. You can have all the money I ever make for the rest of my life if you'll save my daughter. She said, good bet. We'll take that. So she says, oh, so she does. And they said, yeah, she's just very sick and she can't show up. So Pat says, all right, I'll go back. One night I said, Pat, we were talking. I said, what do you make of that? This about you have to learn in another way that's more painful. She said, I don't know. They didn't explain it. And I loved Pat for that. You know why? Because she didn't make up an answer. She said, I don't know. And I like that. Because there's a lot of stuff we just don't know and it's okay. She said, maybe you go to hell and then when you learn it, you get out of hell. I don't think so. I think it's reincarnation. I think you have to come back to an even worse life. She said, I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. They didn't explain it. Now, I said a minute ago that Pat could feel the feelings directly of the men that were working on her, or at least the one man that was working, the other was throwing up his hands in disgust. And that's a very high risk thing for emergency room doctors. They get so upset when they work and work and work to keep people alive, and then someone comes in and tries to throw away their life. To throw away their life. That's so offensive to them. They sometimes have an angry reaction to that, you know. And so it's somewhat understandable. And that leads us to the idea of compassion. Compassion means we try to imagine what other people feel, even though we really can't. We use our imagination, we use our experience, and we try to put ourselves in the shoes of the other person, in the shoes of someone that maybe hurt us, maybe offended us, maybe damaged us in some way, and we try to feel what must they feel. That's compassion. You find over and over again that a lot of people with near-death experiences are much higher on compassion than the regular run-of-the-mill people. You don't need to wait for that. You can learn to be more compassionate today. Here's a simple experiment. Look around a group of people like this, of people you don't know, and in your mind, pretend something. Imagine if you've been adopted and you're at the age of 40, you discover you have a long-lost brother or sister you never knew about, and you're thrilled, and you rush to the airport, and they get off the airplane, and you embrace one another. Oh, you tell me about your life. Tell me about your life. Oh, I'm so thrilled to know I have this brother. I'm so thrilled to know I have this sister. Pretend that everyone in here is a long-lost brother or sister, somebody that you just have forgotten about. That's something I've done as an experiment, as an exercise. It's a good exercise. It really helps you become more compassionate, because then when people do dumb things, I can say, well, you know, it's a family member. My family does a lot of dumb things. What are you going to do? We've all done dumb things. That's another angle with compassion, is you look at yourself and try to figure out the silly things you've done, the times you've offended, the times you've stepped on someone's toes, the times you've been selfish. And then you can look at someone being selfish or dumb and say, I know exactly how that feels. I've done something kind of like that. I mentioned last time, and I'll mention it again, my favorite movie is a movie called Joe vs. the Volcano. It's written and directed by a playwright named John Patrick Shanley. In Joe vs. the Volcano, there's a character named Patricia, played by Meg Ryan. And she tells Joe Banks, who's played by Tom Hanks, she says, my father says that almost all the world is asleep. Everyone you know, everyone you see, everyone you talk to. He says that only a few people are awake and they live their lives in a state of constant, total amazement. Now, I think that's true. Because when you were little, you were amazed at the world. Everything was new, fresh, and exciting. And you looked on the world with innocent eyes, you listened to the world with innocent ears. If people told you a fat man in a red suit would give you presents, you totally believed it. Everything was amazing and exciting. And then you lost that, you forgot about it, and you went to sleep. And you don't remember what it's like to be amazed. But you can wake up. And that's what the near-death experiencers teach us. Wake up. Wake up. Now, I've talked long enough, and I'm out of things to say. Actually, that's not true. I never run out of things to say. I've got a couple of things I should say. Number one, my face looks a little scary. I took an anti-cancer treatment called Epudex. Any of you ever use Epudex? You have? Pretty gruesome, huh? I'm actually almost totally recovered, believe it or not. I looked a lot worse a week ago. It's a good thing. It kills all the precancerous cells in your face. So that's why I look kind of spooky. The other thing I want to mention is I'm finishing up a new book called Clinical Happiness. Okay, we're going to do some question and answers. Maybe we'll do questions and more questions. My answer will be, I don't know. You have one.
I like the suggestions you've made about the world being asleep. And we've learned to go to sleep, but we've also learned to put up walls. Do you have any other techniques that might be beneficial?
Compassion is the way to take down walls. The reason we put up walls is fear and anger. And both of them are delusional experiences, you know. There's nothing to be afraid of because things will go really bad in your life and then you'll die. Why be afraid of that? And anger, there's no reason to be angry because nothing can really hurt you. Nothing outside of you can truly harm you because you are invulnerable. Your body is not invulnerable, but you are not your body. You're more than your body. And so there's never a reason to really be angry or fearful. And the answer to anger and fear is compassion. You can, by the way, if you Google compassion, there's the Buddhists have these really neat exercises for developing that. I kind of like some of the stuff they do. You had a question.
Yes, I would like to know how your research into near-death experiences has affected your career, what it's done for your career, if you faced any opposition from the materialistic status quo.
Well, sure. I run into that all the time. People are disgusted and upset with me for, you know, believing that materialism is a foolish, limited way to look at life. But again, why should I be afraid? I'm not afraid to come out. You know, my face is looking a little bit rugged. I'm not afraid for people to look at me. I'm not afraid if people are offended by what I have researched. You know, I've gone and spoken to medical groups. Some doctors like that, and they'll send me referrals, and they're happy to have that. And then other doctors are disgusted and think I've been brainwashed by the spiritualists. You know. Question.
Yes, thank you. This may be a little bit off the subject, but I've been wondering, every day there are hundreds if not thousands of people that go through death experiences and are revived, primarily in hospitals involving transplants and multiple bypasses in the heart, where the body is taken down to like 65, 68 degrees and except for the heart and lung machine, they're basically dead. The heart and lung machine is just to preserve the body until they're revived, until the potassium is drained out of the heart and then the heart restarts.
So
a lot of these people.
What's the question?
The question is that I realize that there's a cocktail of drugs in the anesthesia that they use so that the patient doesn't remember a lot of what happens while they're under.
Yeah, it depends. I had a knee operation once, and they gave me Versed, and I couldn't remember a darn thing about it, and I was really mad. So when I, the next procedure I had, I wouldn't let them give me Versed, and it was a painful procedure, but I really enjoyed it because I, you know, I thought, oh, this is interesting. I can remember everything that happened. My wife said, why would you want to remember that? Well, it's interesting, you know. So, yeah, I mean, and we don't know. Look, there's no way to tell why some people remember and some don't. Pim van Lommel in the Netherlands found that of people coming into his hospital who were clinically dead, you know, a cardiac, an infarct, a stopped heart, around 22% of them had near-death experiences. Well, what happened to the other 78%? I don't know. My old friend, Jose Mesa, actually, when he came back into his body, the body was still full of heroin, and he couldn't remember what had happened for 6 months. He was doing 90 days in jail up in the Pocatello jail, and he, for the first time in 6 months, he was clean, and it came back to him then. We live in a physical body, and what we can consciously remember is controlled a lot by our physical brain.
The tail end of my question, I have met other people who have had transplants and quadruple bypasses like myself, and who have had visitors that no one else in the room can see, and that happened to me here.
That's a type of near-death experience. Sure, you ought to come up and speak about it. Not tonight, but you know.
I will someday.
Come up and talk to us about it.
Okay, thank you.
Question here.
I consider the possibility that I create my own hell with my own self-disgust or lack of self-esteem or something like that. How do you feel? Does God create a hell? I don't believe that, but how do you feel about that?
Well, it doesn't matter how I feel about it, and it doesn't matter what you feel about it. It's either there or not. My hunch from a very limited sample of Jose and Howard is that hell seems to have an address and a zip code. I don't know how to get letters delivered there. I wouldn't want to be the guy that delivers them. At the same time, both Jose and Howard escaped from hell with a heartfelt prayer. One of our Elaine Durham in the tunnel saw people in hell, and yet she was headed towards the light, and she intuitively knew when she looked at those figures in the dark. In other words, most people go through a tunnel and they don't see what's beyond it. She could see beyond it and see that there were people in the darkness, and they were in hell. And hell's a dark place, you know. And she realized that all they had to do was look. So both of those are true. There is a place, that there is some kind of a location, you know. And at the same time, it's your own mind that keeps you there. It's your own beliefs. Jose said, when this light appeared, he said, all these people watching me, they scattered like cockroaches. Howard Storm thought when the people in hell were biting him and kicking him and scratching him and gouging him, the thought occurred to him, pray to God. And his mind said, oh, I don't do that. That's for weaklings. And then the thought comes from his heart, pray to God. A second time he says, that's for, I don't know how, it's been a long time. A third time the voice says, pray to God. So he says, prayer, something about thee and thou, and it sounds old English, so he shouts out, my country, 'tis of thee, God bless America. The shadow of the valley of death, thou art with me. God love us, watch over our country, you know. And he said these people started backing up. Well, why would they back up? And they screamed at him, there's no God, you're praying to no one, that's stupid, what are you doing? And but he thought, well, this is promising, you know. They're backing up, that looks good to me. So he kept trying to pray, and it was kind of a mishmash of any old things that he could shout out, you know. Now that wasn't a genuine prayer, but it still scared them, see. So how do you stay in hell? You know, probably your own fear, your own self-condemnation, you know, stuff like that.
Could I make an
addendum to that, sort of? To
this, no, get your own show. Go ahead.
I've read quite a few near-death experience books, not all of them. There's still some out there I haven't gotten a hold of yet. I've read several that included an experience in what would be considered either hell, not the biblical hell so much, but a place where, a very negative place, very dark and a painful place in many cases, very dreary place, a place without love. But in all the instances that I've read about or heard about, it never lasted very long. And it turns out, it appears, that the near-death experiencer went there for a short time in order to learn something they needed to learn before they were taken from there to a place of light.
But there are obviously people that are there,
yeah,
pretty much 24/7.
But again, I agree with what you're saying, too. I think it's because they stick themselves there.
Right up to them.
And they just, it's up to them. I don't think it's a place of punishment or anything like that. Like,
but look, here's an interesting thing. There's a guy named J.B.S. Haldane who was a great biologist. I was going to say astronomer. No, was he an astronomer? No, it was Eddington. Eddington's the astronomer. Haldane's the biologist. And he said, it may be that not only is the universe stranger than we think, it's possible that it's stranger than we can think. And so, we don't know what we're talking about here. We're just getting little tiny glimpses of some of the few things that are going on. It's like, you know, if I flew over Chicago and then I'm giving a talk about, you know, what it's like to live there, you know. With these things, we ought to approach this with a certain amount of humility. In psychology, people that get strong theories sometimes let the theories get in the way of relating to their patients. And so whenever I get a theory, I try to lay down until it goes away. Somebody asked me, well, do you believe in evolution? I said, I don't have an opinion about it. Don't remember. Can't remember how we got here, but I don't know why I need to have an opinion about that. A friend of mine wanted to know what I thought about flying saucers, because I interviewed some guys that had been abducted by a flying saucer, and it was kind of an interesting interview. They were terrified, shaking in their, you know, it was fun. I had fun, and they were scared, you know. Yeah. In fact, their psychiatrist, the guy that brought them to me, was so scared that, what was he doing? It's like he couldn't take a bath. He always had to have his clothes there to jump into them in case the flying saucer guy showed up and tried to abduct him. He got a little weird himself, you know. It's fun watching people deal with fear, you know. You know, everything that I'm afraid of is probably just as ridiculous. All my fears. I don't want to, they said, well, what do you believe about them? I said, don't believe anything about them. You know, I don't have a theory. I don't have a theory about hell. Some people have been there and they tell us what it's like. And I say, okay. But I don't think that really proves very much, other than some people got a little glimpse. And we shouldn't be saying, oh, well, this is it and this is it, you know, and becomes some kind of Swedenborg where we're having all of these strong opinions about things we don't know a thing about. That's why I just loved Pat Rippon's answer. What do you mean? You'll have to learn it in another way that's more painful. And she said, I don't know. They didn't explain. And the world is full of people that make up all these theories and all these ideas, and they go way beyond their actual experience. I don't know why we have to have an opinion about hell, because statistically, maybe only one person, this group, is going to hell. Now look around and figure out who he is. He might be sitting right next to you. So anyway, statistically, it's unlikely that many of us will go to hell. Now I've given you a key, you know, which is if you pray sincerely, so far the chance that they're 2 out of 2, you know, that they got out. And they didn't have to stay very long.
I have a comment.
Oh, go ahead.
I was reading a book a while ago when the one girl that said this experience, she feels or she thinks that there's earthbound spirits and then there's spirits that go on to the light. And it's those earthbound spirits that sit in that darkness between our real world and the spirit world. And so there are those that choose to stay in that state
and refuse to go to the light.
That's a real possibility. That's a possibility. See, but when people say that, I say, okay, so how do you know that? You know, how did you learn that? And if it's a supposition, I say, great, you know. And I have other suppositions, and I don't know whether it's true or not. So I would just say, look, what do we know? We know that there's meaning in the world, that you probably, we have two or three people that we've heard from that have chosen their life before they came, and so it's possible that you chose all the troubles that you've had. And I chose the skin cancer and all that kind of dumb stuff, and I want to talk to who designed my knees, have a real heart-to-heart talk with that jerk, because they gave me crappy knees, and I've had two knee operations on each leg with a lot of pain, and I don't like that. But I probably learned a great deal from that. I learned a tremendous amount. And so, you know, then I think, well, you know, it's like maybe I chose that. Maybe that was a... I said, okay, I'll take a dislocating shoulder and some bad knees and a little skin cancer and this and that. And, you know, life's one damn thing after another.
On the Earthbound Spirits, Return from Tomorrow, Dennis Ritchie.
Dennis Ritchie had some fairly good data about that. That I take pretty seriously.
Well, what's interesting about them is...
He came once before he died. He came to Salt Lake. A phenomenal guy.
The thing about the Earthbound Spirits is they feel pretty much as lousy as they did in life. And the alcoholics in the bars, they're trying to get drinks and they can't get the drinks because their hands go through it. They're still alcoholics.
Remember that episode in The Simpsons where Homer is just ahead and he keeps drinking the beer and the beer runs out of it? Of his throat, and he slurps up the beer, it runs out of his throat again. It was a lovely example of an Earthbound Spirit. These people that write The Simpsons are very spiritually deep. By the way, how many fingers do all the characters in The Simpsons have?
Four.
Four fingers. When God appears in The Simpsons, he's a really tall guy with a white beard. You've seen him? How many fingers does he have?
Five.
He has five. I don't know what that means. Don't have a theory about it, but it's interesting. I don't think we ought to get too caught up in this Earthbound Spirit kind of stuff, because my hunch is, frankly, if they have any power, it's only the power that you give them by being scared. Does that make sense? And I don't like talking about it because I think, you know, they're not very interesting people. I had a patient that was absolutely convinced that she was possessed by an evil spirit, and she insisted that I talk to this evil spirit. So I did, and the spirit said, "You don't respect me." And I said, "Well, duh." And you have nothing to offer me. You have the mental acuity of a 13-year-old, frankly. Of course I don't respect you. So I told her that she ought to feel sorry for the spirit that was inhabiting her and pray on his behalf. I told the spirit, "You know, I think you're working for the wrong outfit. And if you pray, somebody will come and lift you to a higher level and you'll get out of this lousy job you've got." Because his job was to try to get her to kill herself. She's still alive. I won, he lost. Ha ha.
Due to the light, it appears that you get to drop your earthly yuck.
Seems likely, yes.
You feel fabulous. So.
Most of the people that have been dead say it's a great feeling, absolutely great feeling.
I was just thinking about what you were saying about gratitude.
Yes.
And
I like that topic. I'm grateful you brought it up.
I think people that's been in the very depths of depression, or even people that have been to hell, even here on earth, to the deepest part of hell, and they find the courage to look at the light and go to it, find the positive part of theirself, those people have more gratitude than somebody that hasn't been there, because it's the opposite of what you really were. And I keep thinking, where in the universe can you go to experience that negativity but here on earth? And that's where we really find the negative part of our beings and our spirit.
Sure.
And it grows because you find the gratitude of being way down in the depths of hell.
Okay, so what did Howard Storm say about this earth? He said...
Same asylum.
He said, is there life on other planets? And these angels that were there said, well, let us show you. And they showed him a bunch of man-like creatures that looked like humans, but were from different planets. And then they showed him a bunch of weirdos that, you know, and he was going, are these intelligent beings? Are these the cows on other planets? What is this stuff? And they didn't explain it. They showed him all these images.
I think in Betty J. Eady, she visited different worlds also.
So he says, okay, there's life on other planets. How much? And these angels said to him, Howard, it's full. The universe is full of life. In fact, there's types of life you don't even have the capacity to understand. He said, wait a minute. If that's true, why don't we know about that? You know, if this universe is full of life, how come these people seem to think we're alone in the universe? And they said, well, you got to understand, your planet is kind of like the worst in the universe. It's under a quarantine, you know. You're not allowed to know this stuff. People don't want to contact you because your planet is full of violence and anger and selfishness. And so you're under a quarantine. You know, Howard's a college professor and pretty has a high opinion of his intellect. And he says, all right, if that's the case, then why would anybody agree to be born on Earth? And what did they tell him? These angels got very excited. And he said, oh, you don't get it. Said, God's favorite people agree to be born on Earth because it is the hardest. It is the hardest place. But we're glad that we have an ugly place to live. We're grateful for it.
Lynn, I just wanted to throw in over here to your left. The fellow you mentioned with cystic fibrosis, he did speak here several times, great speaker, and one of his phrases I've always remembered is, your torment is your mentor. There's something about the things that bother us or that are the torment in our life that if we work with it is actually meant to bring us something positive that's uniquely adapted to us.
Yeah,
great phrase.
It's almost like there's no such thing as meaningless suffering. Anytime you're suffering, it's a gift to you. And, you know, you might say, well, thank you very much, but, you know, the guy that's walking along the cliff and a big gust of wind blows him over the cliff. He grabs onto the bush and cries out, oh, God, save me. And a voice comes to him and says, do you believe in me? Yes, yes, I do. Do you believe I created the wind that blew you off the cliff? Yes, I do. Yes, Lord, I do. Do you believe that I could create an even greater gust of wind that would blow you back up onto the cliff? That's possible, yeah. All right. Let go of the bush. Is there anyone else I could talk to up there? So, we don't like the pain we're in. We don't like the suffering we have to experience. And yet, Don has told us over and over again while he was with us, tormentors or mentors use the pain that you experience for your advantage.
This is something I believe strongly, is that there's power in personal relationships.
That's another thing, I mean, the connection, relationships. There's just so much you can learn, and, you know, each person is given a glimpse. If all of you go to France and you all come back, you'll all have what? Unique, different experiences. Every one of you will have a different experience. France is such an extensive, large country with so many different regions and people and types of food and things like that. And yet, what is that compared to whatever comes after we live? The things we've talked about are simply hints, general ideas that give us a way to go. Joe versus the Volcano was written by John Patrick Shanley. He wrote that screenplay after he had a near-death experience, and he was trying to explain in an artistic way what he learned. Thank you for coming.